today on the podcast.
He's a National Geographic adventurer.
He's an internationally renowned photographer, also a filmmaker.
Corey Richards.
Let's welcome Corey Richards. You've just been in an avalanche that is life-threatening. And your first reaction was to take a selfie?
Yeah, I've got a little Kim Kardashian in me. I think the mountains are very much in me. They, for so long, were so deeply a part of my identity.
Who is Corey Richards?
It's a big question. I've gone through tremendous learning over the past 4 or 5 years. What I do is not who I am.
There's a side to Corey in this podcast that not many people see. Have you ever suffered from any form of anxiety?
Oh, dude, like right now, anxiety is a passenger in my car. Had I not lived every single moment of my life exactly as I have, I wouldn't be here.
What do you think has been the darkest period in your life?
You know,
what's interesting to me, guys, I was digging through my podcast stats the other day on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, all the rest of it, and realized that the majority of people that listen to this podcast don't actually subscribe to the channel. Now, if you could do me one favor, one huge favor, and it's the only favor I'll ever ask from you, and hit that subscribe button or like button, whatever it is, wherever you are, I'd really appreciate it. It helps us so much more than you know. And my promise to you, if you're to do that favor for me, is to make these podcasts bigger and better than ever. Thank you. And with all that said, my name is Harrison Brown. This is the Into the Mind podcast, and let's welcome Corey Richards. Especially as you grow and you get older, to know your lineage and to know where you've come from and where you've been, and especially like you, when you've traveled so many places, it's pretty cool to know like exactly where you come from.
Yeah. And then it's cool to know too, like, I mean, it puts in context your whole history, and, you know, epigenetics are a real thing. So, you know, at least back about 6 generations, it's really interesting to know what happened, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yes.
I don't think people know who I am yet. Did we even introduce?
don't worry. They'll know who you are. I've got a wee intro set at the start of the podcast, so they'll know exactly right. Who you are. But yeah, like, listen, there's so much to get our teeth into. I mean, photography, videography, adventure, mountaineering, mental health. There's so many kind of facets to your life that I find really fascinating. And I know I said to you before the podcast, and I'm fanboying a little bit, but I have been following your journey for years. So I really appreciate the time. And I think to get through everything, I've kind of split it into a couple of categories. So it'd be really interesting to dive into the more photography element first.
Great.
So I suppose I read a bit about you when you were in school, and you kind of joined school 2 years early because you were quite intelligent. Yeah. And then you dropped out at about 14.
That's right.
Yeah. Where'd the photography aspect come in? Like, when did you first pick up a camera?
Well, I mean, look, when I was a kid, you know, I was academically gifted, but really where my heart was always in the arts. And for a long time, I thought I was going to be an illustrator, and I still love to draw. And, you know, I love visual arts. And but I didn't discover photography until I was about 18. And it was coming out of this incredibly tumultuous adolescence that I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about later. But I was going on my first sort of big climbing expedition. We went into a place called the Ruth Gorge in Alaska, or the Great Gorge. And we were doing, I went with a group of, I think, 5 other guys that were really my best friend at the time, but then really the other guys were, you know, in their 50s at that point, even early 60s. They were my dad's old climbing partners. But before I left, I asked my mom if I could borrow her camera. And she acquiesced and sent me on my way. And I bought a whole bunch of rolls of slide film. And I remember coming back, I was living with my aunt and uncle at the time. And putting on a slideshow and just like fully fucking saturating people. I mean, people were falling asleep. They're like, what is this? You know, but I think it was then that I really fell in love with it. And I saw a marriage between or an outlet between what I was experiencing internally, emotionally, and a way to both give that voice, but also to marry it with an activity that also was an expression of myself. And so from a psychological perspective, I really look at it as the marriage. I was trying to marry my body and mind. And as we'll, you know, get into some stuff later, I was missing a key component, but we can come back to that.
Do you remember your first photo that you ever took?
No idea. I don't remember my first photo. There's too many, but I do remember, you know, obviously I remember the first published photos because that was such a big deal.
Hmm.
So, and that one, you know, actually even that's a little blurry because I submitted some to a magazine and I think a climbing magazine, I submitted some from Denali and those got, it was to a competition and two of those got published, but I don't think they were published until after a shot of Stian Hagen on the Frendo Spur above Chamonix. And that was first published by Black Diamond in one of their catalogs.
And was that, do you think that's the first sense of real like achievement that you felt in your life when that got published? Do you think that was the first endorphin rush of kind of the work paying off?
Well, I think, I'm not sure it was the first, but it was certainly an impactful one. I would say it was the first in my adult life because there's so much in the history where I had picked up these stories of deficit, self-deficit, and this idea that I was really fucked up, that I was sort of a lost cause. And yet I knew internally that some piece of me knew that wasn't true. So I was battling with these very paradoxical ideas of myself, which is one is I'm confident and I'm capable of anything really. And to some degree, some grandiosity there, which I think is inherent in young people that has to be. And then there was this other story of like, I don't really matter. And so I think photography was an adaptation to express myself and sort of make a claim or stake a claim in the world in a way to say, look, I matter. I can create things that matter, that people see, that people engage with. And, but it really was, yes, I think, you know, that first photograph, selling it, holding the check in my hand and feeling like, oh, you know, I do matter. And again, as I'm sure we'll revisit, it was it mattered and it didn't, you know?
Do you think that there was a sense of kind of like, almost like purpose when it came to photography?
Yeah, I think it gave me a direction. Climbing and photography together gave me a direction that allowed me to feel a sense of purpose, even if that purpose was to be seen. And that's, you know, we often talk about that as very self-indulgent, but I think so many of us have that desire in the world. And I don't think that it's necessarily bad so long as it's not at the expense of others. But yes, it gave me a lot of purpose. Yeah.
And do you think growing up, I asked this question to a lot of guests and it's quite interesting to gauge the kind of reactions.
Yeah.
Throughout your career, when you were doing photography and these huge adventures and expeditions and, you know, climbing these mountains, would you say you were driven in terms of just being a driven, motivated person? Or do you think you're being dragged from something that you're past that you're maybe more running from?
Yes.
The second one.
No. Yes to both. You know, I don't think it's an either or. I tend to look at the world very much in shades of gray and avoid, really at all costs when I can, any sort of black and white. I don't think it's necessarily one or the other. I think it's both. I am a driven person. And at the same time, I experience specifically with some of the mental health stuff that I navigate, I experience a deep sense of paralysis at times, or at least I have in the past. And so it was that there was very much a sense of that. And also there was a sense of running too. And even I think long-term, not photography, but the act of constantly pursuing high stimulation environments became maladaptive. And so, yeah, it's both.
Did you find yourself pushing yourself further and further to feel that almost dopamine rush because your body was getting used to the hit when you were doing these huge adventures?
Of course. I mean, look, you know, the way we come up in the world is we get both driven and dragged. It's not one or the other. And so, you know, my childhood, specifically my adolescence, was quite chaotic, and it was quite high stimulus, and it was quite high stress. And so it's very normal for people who grow up in those environments to tend towards occupations that mirror that kind of stress. And the reason is because it's familiar, it's known. And so even if it is incredibly uncomfortable or even dangerous, that discomfort is sort of superseded by the comfort of expecting discomfort, you know, or even craving it. And so I think I was naturally inclined to it, because also a chaotic childhood can develop very specific skills for adaptation, and it can develop skills for hypervigilance. And those things, again, they're not necessarily good or bad. Expressed in the wrong environments, they can be maladaptive, but expressed in the appropriate environments, like climbing, hypervigilance is it's an incredibly meaningful skill, you know.
Yeah, and I can imagine it was quite difficult going from the kind of, I've spoken to some SES soldiers about this, and they describe this process of the only thing they need to think about when out in the field is what's the next step. It's like, what's the yeah. next step? What's the next step? They can only think one or two steps ahead. And right. then they come home to this environment where it's like, oh, your taxes are due. You have a parking ticket. You know, you need to cook dinner. What have you got in the fridge? And they kind of get like overstimulated and overwhelmed by the silence. Do you kind of resonate with that?
Oh my God. You know, one of the things that I face most often in my life, or have faced, and it's very much, not, I don't want to say resolved, but is course correcting, is overwhelm. I'm a person who, despite being able to navigate chaotic environments well, I often have a sense of overwhelm, because as you point out, in those chaotic environments, it's very, like the SES guys say, it's one step after the other. And that's how you get through things. That's how you navigate them. When I come back, or, you know, when I was doing a lot of that work, I'd come home and there's not only the overwhelm of everyday life, but there's the requisite silence, to use your word, that stimulation doesn't, again, I think silence can be hyper stimulating. And so it's almost as if you're in this void where paralysis is ever present, because all you want to do is zone out, you know?
Yeah.
And yet what I've learned is that everyday life is just one step at a time too. It's just more minutia.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel that way. I think especially it work for a lot of people when they're juggling like their personal lives with their work balance. And then, as I said, like the parking ticket comes up, and then their tax bill is due, and the cooking's not done, and the kids need, like, it seems in life to be a lot more chaotic in terms of tasks. Whereas I feel like when you're outside some of these places, it's very methodical, and it's almost like you work through a process. You know, if you're going to skydive out of a plane, there's a process in place that you follow the steps. Whereas not having that regulation in place for some people, including myself, is really difficult when you've got the silence of just being at home.
Yeah. But I was just thinking about this, actually. This is such a fascinating line of inquiry and thought. I wonder if the silence is, I actually wonder if home life is more loud because of all these things. So there's a constant noise. There's a constant, I need to get this done. I need to get that done. And I wonder if it's not the discomfort of silence, but the discomfort of noise that's so paralyzing or overwhelming when I come home. Because in the field, there is this methodical, like, path that you take that provides some sort of structure that actually allows for silence or positive silence. I think maybe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the silence that you're referencing is the necessity of sitting with yourself outside of a purpose-driven activity.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It absolutely 100% does. Do you struggle with that?
Oh my God, dude. Sitting with yourself, man, it's like, there's a beautiful book, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, you know, and it's just like sitting with yourself is incredibly hard, especially when you have a high intensity personality where the activities that you engage with can help you escape it, because you don't need to do any self-work there. You might be learning, but you don't need to do any real self-excavation there. And it's only in that silence and that quietude that I've found that I have really grown. Of course, doing these things, there's an element of growth. I'm not saying that that doesn't exist, and I'm not saying it's not healthy. What I am saying is that the most impactful and generative work I've done is when I put all that aside and really went inward. Oh, dude, it's the most fucking uncomfortable thing in the world. It's so hard. Because we're forced into confrontation with ourselves, at least if we're doing, you know, I kind of hate the idea of doing the work, but if we are doing the work, that's where all the big growth happens, because we have to look at ourselves.
And how did that come about, that first step? Because I know there was a point in your life where you said, listen, I'm not done with photography, but I'm going to put the camera down for a little bit and stop the adventures for a bit and kind of look introspectively. When did that kind of come about, and how did that kind of happen?
Well, I mean, it was a series of things, and it was an evolution, because when I was climbing Gasherbrum 2 in the winter in 2010-11, and we summited, and then we were on the descent, we got hit by this big avalanche, and I took a pretty meaningful photograph, and it was of myself. It was a selfie, and then that goes on the cover of National Geographic. It was after that that when I started to see, you know, my professional life accelerating and my personal life unraveling, that I got curious about what was happening inside. And it wasn't until 2012, when I was on Everest and I got evacuated, that, you know, a doctor said to me, "I wonder if you had a panic attack." And I've gone back and I've really gotten honest about that. I think part of that was sort of a PTSD reaction to the avalanche on Gasherbrum 2. But I also think, not think, I know that there was a really important piece of it that was me just not wanting to be there and finding a way out because I was too overwhelmed. So it was some level of escapism as well. And for a long time, I just said, oh, it was a panic attack. But deep internally, I knew that that wasn't entirely true. And so that caused a degree of discomfort, because I knew I was out of integrity and I knew the story I was giving to people wasn't entirely honest. So then, you know, 2012 happens, but now I've got this idea of trauma in my head and I start going deeper into that. Now that's, what is that? That's 13 years ago. What finally happened was I was training for a new route on Everest. We had tried once. COVID happened as a major disruptor. We continued to train, but the Everest season got canceled twice. And second time it got canceled, my partner Topo and I decided we'd go to Dalagiri and climb with his girlfriend Carla. They're both incredible guides, Ecuadorian guides and climbers. So we weren't climbing as a guided team; we were climbing as just climbing partners. And I had what would be classified as a mixed bipolar episode in base camp. And again, I look at that now and I go, "Yes, it was bipolar. Yes, it is the, you know, somewhat related to the way my mind is wired or has been wired." And it's also related to being out of integrity and the stress of that. And what I mean by that is that I knew on some fundamental level that I needed to stop. I couldn't sustain the high stimulation. I didn't want to sustain it. And so it was a moment of walking away. And it's something that I talk a lot about when I'm speaking is resilience. Because it would be easy, very easy for people to look at my life and go, oh, that's it's resilient. He's very resilient. I would actually argue something different. I would say I'm highly adaptable and I'm highly tolerant of certain things. And those two things are key components of resilience, but that's not what it always is. And, you know, and the reason I don't say it's resilience is because you look at the outcomes of many of the decisions I made, and they were not the most positive generative outcomes. Resilience is the most positive outcome, most generative outcome to hard situations. What I was doing was surviving. And a lot of times those survival mechanisms really worked in my favor, but a lot of times they didn't. You can see that because I just keep burning down my life. And so after that happened in 2021 and I set the camera down, I set climbing aside, there was only one place left to go. Well, there was two. One was into love and trying to anchor myself to an outsourced source of love. And when that didn't work, there was one place left to go, and that's in. So when I exhausted all the external sources of distraction, value, love, I was forced into myself, and I, at least the invitation was there, and I took it.
So much to unpack there. And literally so much to unpack there. As you were speaking, I was like, right, there's so many points I'll pick up on here. I think So starting from the start, there was the photo, the selfie that you took that ended up on the cover of the magazine of Nat Geo. I mean, firstly, how does that come about? You've just been in an avalanche that is life-threatening, and your first reaction was to take a selfie?
Yeah, I've got a little Kim Kardashian in me. we all do.
You know, I think in life, things that you can attach sentimental value to are what means most to us. And throughout my life, I've attached tons of value to my watches. And I'm actually a watch collector. And that's where the sponsor of the podcast, Chisholm Hunter, comes in. Chisholm Hunter are a luxury watch and diamond retailer. They've been going for over 165 years and they're family run. They stock brands like Vacheron Constantin, which I know that Corey touches a bit on this podcast because he's actually an ambassador for Vacheron Constantin. And he had this beautiful watch that was crafted and actually has his picture of Mount Everest on the back of it called the Vacheron Constantin Overseas Everest Edition. It's one of my grail watches. But anyway, moving on. Chisholm Hunter stock Vacheron Constantin. They also stock brands like Tag Heuer, Amiga, Tudor, Tissot, Seiko, pretty much everything you can think of. Chisholm Hunter are the authorized retailer of those watches and also they're world renowned for their luxury diamonds. If you are looking for something for yourself or a loved one, head to chisholmhunter.co.uk. That is chisholmhunter.co.uk. And while you're on the Chisholm Hunter website, use the discount code CHSUB, that is CHSUB, for an exclusive 10% off selected lines. That is CHSUB on the Chisholm Hunter website for your next luxury watch or diamond. And on that note, let's get back to the conversation at hand with Corey.
I think what it was, the way I framed it, and I can't be certain, it's just an idea, it's a story that I tell, is that I knew, you know, I felt the fucking frozen ice on my face. I knew the history of exploration. I knew what photos hit. So that exists in my mind. The other thing that I know is that photography, as much as it can be an act of flow, it's also, the camera is literally a barrier or a boundary between us and the world. So a lot of people think of it as like, oh, photography is this very present act. I don't think of it that way. I think of it as an act of creative flow, which quiets the mind, but you're still focused very much outside of yourself on a very singular thing. I think of presence as being in awareness both of yourself and the totality of things around you. And we get there through different means and methods. It can be psychedelics, it can be meditation, it can be all sorts of things. But yes, when the avalanche stopped, I was aware of myself and I was aware of what I looked like and I was aware of what just happened. I was aware of the moment that seemed important and I felt my emotions cresting. And so I, you know, I turned the camera on myself and I took a picture. And it was 2 years later that it ended up on the cover of the 125th anniversary issue. I mean, I think of it very much in terms of like war photographers. One of the ways that people navigate this stuff is because they have a barrier between them and the horror. And yeah. So potentially the story I've played with a lot is trying to distance myself from what I was experiencing. So it was a compartmentalization of those things.
That really resonates. I think the method of kind of having a barrier in between you and the world that dissociates yourself mm-hmm. would definitely help cope with something so traumatic like that.
And it becomes very isolating.
Hmm.
Because you're always, as a photographer, you're quite literally always on the outside looking in.
And do you think that became a bigger issue as it went on because of the isolating aspect of photography?
Potentially. I mean, again, these are all theories. Sometimes I speak in these definitive truths, or I did for a very long time. But one of the things that I play with so much right now is storytelling and looking at the stories I tell and wondering, hey, is that true? Is that in alignment with my integrity? And is it holding me back or helping me move forward? And we can't escape storytelling. It's what our minds do. But I think being mindful of the story we tell is important. And so when I look at that, I just say that to be very clear that, you know, I think it had a lot to do with that, but I can't be certain. You know, I tell that story to make sense of things.
Yeah, and I suppose people, when they go through something that traumatic, they try and rationalize it, and they try sure. to kind of talk themselves down a little bit in terms of how dangerous maybe the situation was. You right. mentioned there psychedelics, and that's something that's quite interesting to me. Is that something that you've tried, or are you looking at, or you're interested in?
So funny. In my adolescence, you know, I was in rehab and hospitals, and I picked up this narrative of sort of like, my mind is broken, and if I do drugs, I'm going to fall off the edge of the earth. I'll go crazy. And as I got older, you know, again, after this incident on Dalagiri, when I moved to LA, I got more curious. And even before I moved to LA, when I was in that very deep depression after Dalagiri, because it caused a great deal of upheaval in my life, people were angry at me. We were making a film. We were, you know, we had spent a lot of money and we had spent a lot of people's time. And so for me to be like, fuck it, I'm out. People were like, what the hell? And then I, after that mixed episode, I dove into a very, very deep suicidal depression. And when that happened, I did ketamine for the first time. I did a ketamine protocol. And I will say that it changed my life, perhaps saved my life. And so I started to believe more in the power of the psychoactive materials and drugs to help with the internal landscape. And so basically, and I like to make this joke now, I'm like, give me drugs. Like, I'll take drugs, you know. but there are very specific kind of drugs. And I went into that world heavily for a moment and, you know, for about a year. And I was doing there's a guy named Armand who has he's very well known all over the world that has these, you know, facilitates these groups. And I will call them medicines, really helped reorient me. And they started to shift the stories in my head. They opened up some ideas around, you know, what stories I was telling. And revisiting what we talked about earlier is this marriage between the mind and the body. what I was missing there, and this is not to sound woo-woo or whatever, what I was missing there is the essential component of the heart. And what we know now is that the heart is an essential piece of emotion processing. Emotion processing starts in the heart, sends a signal up the vagus nerve, which then is sustained in a bilateral conversation between the two. And so what psychedelics did was reintroduce me to the heart. And the idea of them is integrating those three components, the mind, body, and heart. And they illuminated to me what gratitude is. I think, you know, I always spoke the word, but I never really understood what it meant. And after I started doing psychedelics and I started feeling from that space more, which is void of words, it doesn't have resolution, it doesn't seek for that. It's very, very silent in the heart. And yet it has so much to say. It was when I started to understand what gratitude meant, that's when my world started to really, really shift. And I started to see everything that had happened and everything that was around me as worthy of gratitude, even the darkest stuff, especially the darkest stuff. I started to see the relationships that I had had through my life that were so, so hard and painful, as I started to see those people as my greatest guides and teachers, and that I could extend gratitude to them and extend great love to them and see them as these incredible sources of growth and education. And then more recently, I know this is a long-winded answer, but I want to give people a lot of background here because it's important. I think psychedelics get wildly overused. I think people, you know, tend to speak of them, oh, I'm doing a journey or whatever, and they just want to get high. And that's also okay. I'm not saying getting high on psychedelics is somehow bad. I just like it when people are very honest with what they're doing with it. But recently I haven't been doing as much, largely because I know that I don't have to go to space to see the stars. I can experience what I would sort of describe as psychedelic awakenings or understandings of the world around us without the drugs. And that's really the point. You know, there's the old saying in psychedelics that says, once you get the message, you can hang up the phone. You don't have to keep going back. And if you do, that's great. But the other thing with this stuff is it's very easy to create new stories that also might not be that beneficial.
Yeah, I find it fascinating how much political pressure there is on the making these psychedelics illegal, especially here in the UK. And I know that I've spoken to, as I said before, the kind of SAS boys and the Marines, and these guys went through unbelievable shit, like being shot at, their cars being set on fire, and they had such a huge barrier in their head that they couldn't talk about this stuff. And that resulted in huge amounts of PTSD. And it wasn't until some of them did MDMA therapy that I'm not saying they fixed the issue, because it's always going to be a huge traumatic issue, but they were finally able to talk about it. They were finally able to release. It was almost like a kettle about to boil. They were finally able to release some of that pressure. And I think it's really odd to me that the government are so, especially in the UK, are so kind of restrictive on the legalization, but also the kind of the studying aspect of what these drugs can actually do.
Yeah, part and parcel is that it's, you know, well, actually, in its totality, it's comes from the war on drugs, which was started by Harry Anslinger in the early 1900s, and which developed into the DEA, which then becomes a part of American governmental fabric. And then it was proliferated and put forward or pushed forward by political pressure on other countries to adopt the same mentality. And so, a lot of it was racial too. Sort of the prohibition of drugs became a very deeply ingrained and the danger of drugs became a very deeply ingrained story in American culture, and then by virtue of politics, the world culture. That's not to say that drugs, certain drugs, don't have very dangerous impacts, and it's not to say that everybody should be using them. I'm not suggesting that at all, but when you look at prohibition and what it's done, it's basically, it's created cartels by creating a black market. And if these, my opinion is, if people were smart, if governments were actually smart and invested in their people, first and foremost, the research into, you know, there's so much lip service paid to mental health, but at the same time, you see the profound positive impacts of these compounds on making people healthier. And so, you know, if my feeling is one of the best things that we could do for society and culture is end the war on drugs. And as much as the next piece of that, which is giving those substances into the control of the government and the care of the government for the appropriate access, you know, that then we start to see certain pieces of crime go away, certain pieces of trafficking go away, because you take the black market out. People are always going to get high, and we're not the only animals that get high. Many animals eat psychoactive substances to alter their states of consciousness. And so it's really fear-based, and it's also fear that most of us have inherited from generations ago, right? So we don't even know necessarily the truth about them because they've been, you know, blacklisted. So I'm very pro end the war on drugs, tax them, make them accessible in the ways that are appropriate, regulate them. Now, of course, that puts them in the hands of big pharma, which is also problematic. But I think in so many ways, it would change the narrative, certainly change the narrative. And I think it would also change the landscape of mental health dramatically.
I would totally agree. And on that point of animals doing drugs to get these psychoactive drugs as well, did you see that dolphins actually play with pufferfish to release the like a very specific amount of the poisonous chemical to essentially get high?
I mean, I've heard that. Water buffalo eat poppies. You saw that in Vietnam. You know, under high stress circumstances, water buffalo eat poppies to get the psychoactive ingredients. Elephants eat fermented fruit. Certain birds eat different fruits that alter it. You know, look at catnip. I mean, we feed our animals catnip and watch them go crazy and giggle. And then we somehow think like, oh, we're the only animals that get high. Fuck that. I mean, animals like it, you know, and we are an animal.
Yeah, I would agree. And do you think that the psychoactive kind of, you were mentioned ketamine there, and the fact that you kind of had, I don't want to call it an awakening, but you, was it clarity that came over you?
Clarity. I would say it was the openness to a different way of thinking. Clarity came later. But it was an openness to a reimagining of the stories. And it was an openness to a much bigger, again, I'm very pragmatic about this stuff, and I am a consummate skeptic. So it wasn't until I started doing it that I really had the sense of, oh, this is what this is about. So I would say clarity came later, and I would say initially what it was a sort of a hard reboot in my mind that allowed me to see things in a much greater totality.
And do you think that drew you back to photography, or have you felt a draw back into photography and back into the mountains, or is it still not on the horizon for you?
There's a draw. There's an unquestionable draw. I mean, I think the mountains are very much in me. They for so long were so deeply a part of my identity. And I think that's what's different now, is I don't want them to be necessarily part of my identity, but being in those environments is incredibly impactful and so, so beautiful. And it's part of the totality of things, and it's part of my totality. Photography is interesting to me because it's not what I necessarily want to do. And yet I can pick up a camera and make shit that moves people. So there's a sense of almost responsibility to it that I don't want to completely put it aside. And I would not continue to do either because of this, but there is a certain amount of external pressure. It's like, you should keep doing that. Don't let it go. Don't let it go. I'm a person who, once I've done something at sort of the highest level, I oftentimes feel a need to move on. And I think I got to that point with photography. Certainly there's other things that I could do with it. I could keep going with it, but I felt very complete with it. But like this spring, I'm doing a residency at Oxford, which is so funny. High school dropout ends up at Oxford.
Full circle.
And I'm photographing for them, and I've got a fun sort of conceptual idea of how to make some images that will be different. And you know what? They might hate it, but I'm going to do it anyway because that's my freedom.
And listen, you said there that your photography moves people, and I think it'd be very sad to see you go from that scene, because I think it does, it genuinely does move people. And it's been something that I've been thinking about recently as well. There's this constant spiel of the same photo copy and pasted on Instagram and social media platforms. Yeah. How do you think you take a photo that means something a little bit deeper than the standard photo you see on Instagram?
Well, it's subjective, right? So my sense, my North Star in that is, does it move me? And if the same, you know, if it is the same photo as everybody else is taking, but it moves you, fine. My question or my curiosity or my suggestion to especially students starting into this world or people who are diving into photography is, why are you trying to make the photo you're making? Is it because somebody else has made something similar and you like it? That's fine too. Or is it because it genuinely is coming from a place of curiosity that is illuminating something to you and the world around you? But the problem with social media is that it's based on algorithmic sort of underpinnings that propagate what people are clicking on. And so there's something to be said for like, hey, look, everybody's clicking on these same images. Is that because we're programmed to like them, or is that because they're actually good? And if the little person, big landscape thing is constantly getting liked because it inspires some level of awe and wonder, just because it's widely shared or widely repeated doesn't mean it's bad. It just means that there's something about it that's moving people. For me, moving beyond those kinds of images has been really important. They're so removed. You know, those images are very, very removed. And what I'm curious about is getting closer to the human.
I think you said it absolutely brilliantly there, that the photos are removed. You can't feel any kind of personality from them. I was having a look through your photos kind of before this, and there's a real sense of being there almost.
Yeah. I would call it, thank you for that, by the way. I would call it intimacy. And we crave intimacy in a world of isolation. And so photos have the capacity to do that, but the way to do that is to move in.
And how do you create more intimacy in your photos?
By noticing what makes you feel intimate. And intimacy, not in the terms of romance and love. That's a very specific kind of intimacy. And certainly that can be infused in your photography depending on what you're photographing. But what makes you feel close to something? What makes you feel like you're a part of it? What expression is there that both sparks your curiosity, but and might even make you feel uncomfortable? What is it that's making you feel uncomfortable when you get closer? Those are the questions that I think are the most important. Certainly like war photography, things where there's just atrocity and whatnot, those are naturally highly emotionally stimulating. But they're not the only pathway to the limbic system, you know? There's a photograph of one of mine of a polar bear, and it's, you know, one of my more well-known photographs standing on this piece of ice. And there's, it looks sort of like the last piece of ice. And there's a waterfall coming down in the background, but it feels lonely. It feels heartbreaking and beautiful at the same time. It's this magic and majesty that is somehow, there's a sense of loss when you look at it. And there's a sense of being there. There's a sense of quietude and isolation. And that is intimate, because it brings up feelings in us that are not always shown on the surface level. So it demands a confrontation with the world around us. And that, you know, the big, like, big landscape, little person, that inspires awe. And I love those photographs. They're not bad, like I said, but there's no sense of confrontation with the world around us.
Would you say the photo of the polar bear is the most meaningful photo to you?
No. I couldn't, it's just one that, you know, 'cause so often people think of intimacy as human.
Yeah.
But there is deep intimacy in the natural world. And it's just one that came to mind. I could never say which one's the most meaningful to me. They're all meaningful. Yeah. And by the way, the photographs that people see, like in my book, Bipolar, you know, it's 300 photographs out of millions. And most of them are shit. That's the thing that people don't understand. There's a fucking, you know, raid system behind me of mostly garbage photographs, you know. You're talking about, it's 1% that you're getting.
Yeah. I think it's the connection that we have to the photographs. And I think a lot of the time, and I was going to ask you about this because I did see it on your wrist, a lot of the time we share the same intimate connection with, you know, watches or vintage cars, or and we share that kind of emotional draw to them because of a shared experience or because something that we link to that thing. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me a little bit about the Vacheron on your wrist?
So this one is, I've worked with Vacheron now for, I think, Vacheron Constantin, the oldest Swiss watchmaker in the world. I think I've worked with them for 7 or 8 years now. We did a collaboration on a watch that was taken to Everest for that attempt on the Northeast face. And it was beautiful. And this watch is not that. This is my everyday. It's part of the overseas collection. But I think you bring up a really interesting point about objects with soul. And we can identify that when we walk into a building. Certain buildings have a feeling, whether we want to acknowledge that as something ethereal or not. We all know what it means like to walk into a building that has a feeling, and it doesn't have to be some grand building. It can be a house. It can be a very small structure. And I think, and watches are the same. And I think what that is these objects are either imbued with a sense of history and living, and that experience, of the structure has somehow taken that on. Or when it comes to things like watches, cars, there is a sense of the amount of effort and taken to put into them to make them that is palpable. There's a sense of care. There's a sense of refinement and perfection to the degree that we can attain it, that makes the object feel alive. And specific to watches, you know, I think watches are emblematic of time, and time is our most valuable commodity. It's not even a possession, but you can't buy it. You can't reverse it. You can't, it just is. And so watches, I think, are emblematic of that. Even in some small way, they remind us that this is finite.
Absolutely. And I think that's actually a really beautiful, beautiful thing. It's funny how fast time goes, isn't it? Like when you're younger, you think you have so much time. And then all of a sudden it's like you're 30, now you're 40, now you're 50. It's like, it's so fast.
It's fast. It's funny, there's a concept called time dilation where time both goes slower and faster, sometimes concurrently, sometimes differently. I mean, the Einstein sort of proved that, right? Like, it's not just like this ethereal concept. It's like time literally speeds up and slows down. And depending on the circumstance that we're in, the brain sort of has a hard time making sense of what's happening fast and slow. And it's a really interesting thing because, as you point out, like, you remember that sort of the dog days of summer when you're little and you're just like, oh my God, it's hot. These days are forever. And you can just do so much. And then as you grow up, and, you know, I'm considered middle aged now because I'm in my mid 40s. All of a sudden, like, weeks tick past, months tick past, years tick past. And then, you know, my dad very recently passed away. He hated that. My dad died. He hated past.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Oh, thank you. It was the best thing. But it was so interesting to be there with him as he was going through these final days of his life and to see that all of the acquisition, all of the amassing of knowledge, of things, books, whatever it is, it's all somewhat, well, it's all completely obsolete at the end. And time as it passes, I would hope for most people, would illuminate the massive futility of what we spend so much of our energy trying to do or get. And if we allow it, time teaches us everything. And coincidentally, and kind of in a fucked up way, time might not exist at all. It's just the way our reality occurs to us.
With all that in mind, what do you think the meaning of life is?
Oof.
It's a big question.
It's a big question. And look, all of this is going to go away someday. Earth, the solar system, sun, all these planets, it's just going to go away. And eventually the last word that was ever written, the last piece of paper, the last letter, all the invention, all of this will just cease to exist. And I think a lot of people think of that as very, very sort of overwhelming. And they think, well, that makes me feel sort of like nihilistic or like, what's the point? And I think we all have moments of that in our lives where we're like, what the fuck is the point? And I think it's a good question to ask. I look at that as very liberating because it means that I get to choose where I put meaning. I get to choose what I spend my time doing. And for me, the meaning of life is boiled down most simply to love. And I don't mean romantic love. I mean love, like it, the huge umbrella of love that makes space for every single thing, as horrible as it might be. We can always draw the circle wider to love. We can love it for its totality. We can love it for the pain it causes. We can love it because it causes pain. We can, if we allow ourselves there. So if there is a meaning at all, it would be love. And by virtue of that, it would be service. To be of service of humanity, to be of service of the people we love and the people we don't know. And, you know, I think we all get to define our purpose in regards to that. And there is no sense that there's no thing, there's no extension of service that is too small. And just because you make money for it doesn't mean that it's necessarily bad. The conflict in that, the problem with that is many people have different ideas of what the best act of service is, and they're often contradictory. But if you see through that and you can see somebody is trying to be of service, then we can always appreciate that. Doesn't mean we have to like what people are doing.
You've kind of broken my brain a bit there. I'll have to go back and replay that. I think, listen, in life, I think a lot of people, they need a purpose. And when they don't have a purpose, you'll see that because they kind of act out and they go and drink and blind themselves with alcohol or drugs. It could go any way. And a lot of people are kind of searching for that purpose. But the problem lies, and I feel like this kind of happened with me and potentially maybe, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but it maybe happened with you, is they find their thing, which might be photography or videography or watches or cars, and they wrap their identity around that thing because it's their purpose at that point in their life. But the problem is, 10 years later, it might not be their purpose anymore, but their identity is so wrapped up in it that they don't really know what else to do.
Yeah. I mean, that's been, I think, the last 5 years of my life, is understanding that what I do is not who I am. And also, I would say here, this is a very important distinction that was illuminated to me by the work I do with my men's community. We think of purpose as action, like what I'm supposed to do in life. But purpose is not that. The actions are an extension of purpose. So my purpose is to tell stories. That's the action that follows purpose, or is the expression of purpose. Purpose is something like connection, or allowing. Or, and by allowing, I mean allowing people to see themselves most fully, the invitation into that. Purpose is, it can be family. It can be, you know, purpose can be as simple as love. And when we default to that and we go deeper, then we see how many things that we do can be an extension of that purpose. And it's very, very freeing, because I think we conflate this idea that I have to find my purpose, which is essentially we're saying I have to find what I'm going to do. But that's not purpose. You know, purpose is fundamental to our being. Purpose is so much deeper than that. And all the doing is just a try. It's, you know, we're kind of throwing spaghetti at the walls to see what actually locks in to our purpose. So when we're defining purpose, it's both easier in that context and harder, because we really have to think about what it is. We have to think, well, what is my purpose? What are my values? And I, you know, if you ask somebody their values, they're going to list off honesty and tell you like all these things. And I think it's not lazy, but it's just that people haven't necessarily gone deep. And yet at the same time, somebody who's gone deep might have the same words for their values, but there's a palpable sense of depth that at least I can very much feel. And those values will end up driving the purpose, and that purpose will then be aligned with both the values and guided by the understanding that if I'm in alignment with my values, then I'm in integrity. And if I'm in integrity, the path forward might be very different.
Why do you think people find it hard nowadays to look introspectively? You had a good phrase there where you said to look deep, to look deep within you and figure out what really is your purpose, not what society is saying is your purpose or your job is saying is your purpose, you know, looking deeper than that. Why do you think in society nowadays it's difficult for people to look introspectively?
Well, because part of it is, I think, you know, money. And I'm a capitalist, right? Like I'm not sure there's a better system, but I think it's out of balance right now. But because money is the highest calling, because money signals freedom and comfort and all these things, even though we know that past a certain point it has no real bearing, aside on from what seat you get in an airplane and what you're eating, you know, at night and the kind of house you live in. Which, by the way, none of those things actually are correlated with any sense of contentment or happiness. They can provide momentary, like, oh, I like this. Luxury is great. But because money is so important to us and we rely on it so heavily, we are constantly in the pursuit of that. And so it's almost it blocks us from, I mean, we have to survive first and foremost. So if we're in survival mode, as the world is very much thrust us into now by virtue of the 24-hour news cycle and social media, our nervous systems are constantly in fight, flight, freeze. And so there's no space to look internally. You know, I got to survive. I got to survive. I got to survive. The realignment there for me comes from noticing my nervous system, really being like, am I keyed up right now? What's this making me feel? But also understanding that most of the time there's a perceived threat, but not a real threat. I'm not saying that's always true, but there's a big difference between the two. You know, if you're in the woods and, you know, bears are there, but no bear is chasing you, that is a perceived threat. It exists, but the bear is not chasing you. That's a different thing. And so I think, you know, we are constantly living in a world of mixing up perceived threat and real threat. And for me, it's come back to, look, I have enough. I'm safe. Nothing is actually wrong. I might have a huge tax bill that I don't know how I'm going to get out of, but I'm actually okay in this moment. I really, really am. And this will work itself out no matter what. If everything will be okay in the end, if it's not okay, it's not the end. You know, and so we live in a society based on this constant thrust of capitalistic survival that ignites our nervous systems into a state where we can no longer take the space to look inward. And also, look, it's all gamified. So we're on our phones all the time, taking up time that we could be using to go inside. But it's an external distraction that keeps us from ourselves.
Have you ever suffered from any form of anxiety?
Oh, dude, like right now?
Yeah. Like 5 minutes before the podcast?
Yeah, like 5 minutes, like getting from the gym to here to do this, you know, like... Man, anxiety is a big piece of my life, but anxiety is, it's funny, I've got a friend, Morgan, who's writing a book, and one of the chapters is called Anxiety and Other Imaginary Problems. anxiety is a signal, right? It's our nervous system signaling us that something is out of alignment. And some of us, because our brains are very much wired to notice those threats more often, live in a constant state of anxiety. And again, this goes back to the previous idea that, like, our culture is built basically on anxiety right now. So yes, the short answer is yes, I feel anxiety. I feel anxiety about many, many things. And I make space for the fact that the goal is not to escape anxiety, but pay attention to it. Not feed into it, but pay attention to it. It has a lot to say. That's where a lot of the work is. What am I anxious about? Now, again, outside of the realms of sort of, you know, normal or the myth of normal behavior, there are extreme cases of anxiety that demand a different kind of attention. And I've experienced that as well. That's part of bipolar. That's part of depression. That's part of ADHD and ADD and all these terms that we use to describe sets of behaviors and experiences that we go through. And so I've experienced that as well. And anxiety can be very paralyzing. And I have a lot of compassion for people who live in that space because I've lived in that space. The irony of anxiety and the paralysis that comes with it is that we only add more anxiety to the plate, because when we're paralyzed, we're not moving forward. And small things become monsters because we stack them up. Okay, all these things that I'm not doing, we just stack them up. And then we're thinking about everything we have to do. And what do? We get into overwhelm. And then what does overwhelm trigger? Anxiety, you know? So yeah, long answer to a short question. Fuck yeah. Anxiety is a passenger in my car.
Yeah, absolutely. I think because I've got the same. I was on medication for anxiety for years when I was younger, and it's because I wasn't fully listening to my brain. I think that I've got very bad ADHD, so I need physical exercise all the time, or my brain just spins out of control. And I think that a lot of people nowadays are kind of masking the issue with the sticking plaster, which is medication, which sometimes is needed, but as a temporary measure, and they're not actually listening to their brain. Have they eaten good food today? Have they exercised today? Are they doing something that they love, or are they stuck in something that they hate? They don't really think about that because they've just kind of stuck the plaster over it.
Yeah, I mean, they're paralyzed by it. And that's sort of one of the great tricks of anxiety. Similar to, you know, you use a chemical analogy. That's what nicotine does. Nicotine doesn't do it. I mean, it's a minor stimulant, but all nicotine does is create the desire for more nicotine. That's its only, you know, purpose. And in the same way, all anxiety does is create behaviors that create more anxiety. And so we get stuck in these stories, and oftentimes they come with a tremendous amount of blame. And this is another component of resilience, is we want to outsource our discomfort, our pain, our anxiety, and we want to find a reason for it. So either that's a diagnosis, that's a person, that's a circumstance, and that's helpful to a point where we say, okay, this is causing this. But also we can get very deeply stuck in those stories and narratives, and we just repeat them, and we think that by understanding it, we're somehow healing it, when in fact we're just reinforcing it. And so agency in all of this is essential. Agency is a huge piece of resilience. It doesn't, at some point, it no longer matters why or how or who. It matters that you are feeling this. And so the immediate course of action is not to figure it out, but to address the thing that's happening and find meaningful tools that work for you to get out of it. And that can be medication. I'm not saying medication is bad at all. I still take medication, not for anxiety, but for bipolar too. I'm pro medication, but I think we're over medicated.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I would agree. I think when it comes to children, especially, that's where I kind of raise my eyebrows a little bit. I think that a child that is over energetic doesn't need medicated with ADHD medication. Perhaps they should grow up and then we can decide what to do with them.
Well, it's funny because I talk about this all the time. One of the most beneficial things for well-rounded adults is unstructured playtime as children. Alone playtime. Of course, we have to monitor our kids and make sure they stay safe. But one of the gifts that I had growing up was a lot of unstructured playtime. And I'm so grateful, because if I didn't have that, I can't imagine the person I would be today. But we look at classrooms and we've got these kids bouncing off the walls, and we go, well, they're hyperactive, you know, they have, and that's causing outbursts. And so, you know, they need to be medicated. Well, the educational system writ large is absolutely fucking sideways. What 8-year-old kid should be sitting in a chair for 8 hours a day? Nobody. That's not how we're built. That's not how we evolved. And so to think that because a child is anxious, can't sit still, and then acting out because of it is because they have some fundamental, they're neurodivergent, I think is a really bad understanding. I think, you know, but nobody's looking at it going, well, why are we asking kids to sit in a chair 8 hours a day? And again, it goes back to the system that we've built, where they need to grow up and they need to get a job and they need to get educated. Well, yes. And is there a different way we can do that?
Yeah, I think the schooling system, I might be wrong in my facts here, but it's one of the only systems throughout history that has remained relatively unchanged. Like everything is moving on. AI is coming into play. You know, the computers were a massive thing. Phones were a huge thing. But if you look at the schooling system, it's more or less the same. Like, there's not been much change, even with everything we know at the moment. There's been very, very little in the way of change in the schooling system, which I think is really quite bizarre.
It's bizarre, and it's bizarre that, you know, and I don't know. Look, classroom work is important. But also kids are very, very, they're smart, meaning that they will gravitate towards the things that make the most sense if they're given the freedom to choose most of the time. Now that's going to take longer for some kids, but yeah, of course, classroom work is important. The other thing that I think is really fascinating about this is I don't know why teachers are so underpaid. If you made that profession one of the most competitive by making it the most highly paid and the most rigorous to take part in, you would change the education system. You know, so if you start offering teachers huge salaries, because look, everything comes from teachers. Why the fuck are we paying them basically the least amount of money? They're responsible for the future. And so if you got more teachers who are more highly qualified, who are getting paid more, and you made that a competitive industry to get into, not a default because I like kids, you would change everything. But convincing governments that that is, you know, like, look, I mean, how, like, professional sports players, great, they provide entertainment and they get paid that much because they draw crowds, which is incredibly financially generative, right? But should anybody, you know, who's throwing a ball down a court, now forgive me, all you athletes out there, should they be getting paid tens of millions of dollars when a teacher taught them how to throw the ball down the court? A teacher guided them to that path, a coach, whatever it is. Why is that teacher, why is that coach, why is that instructor not getting paid far more or at least equal to that wage? I mean, it's mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, I would totally agree. And I think in the UK especially, I'm not sure how it is where you are, but we're having real issues with that at the moment because they're cutting back the finances for the teachers in the schooling systems, and you're seeing the repercussions of it. I mean, teachers in general should be finding what the kid is good at and pushing them towards that. And as a result, the children will find their purpose. They'll find what makes them tick. They'll find their tribe. If they don't find their purpose, they'll be sleepwalking a lot of life. And it's really, really sad. It actually made me think, do you believe that we create our own purpose, or is it something that we discover along the way?
What a good question. Again, I think the answer is yes. I think, you know, maybe purpose is innate, but certainly I think outside influences help define what that is. Any situation we're born into is going to have an impact on how we, again, form our values and find what that purpose is. But again, we're probably using purpose in the sense of doing right now. So, you know, and that's okay. It's just a different thing. We're talking about defining what we're going to do in life. But it's a really good question, and I'm not sure I really even have a clear answer to it.
What do you think has been the darkest period in your life?
You know, for a long time, I would have said my adolescence, and there was some darkness there, you know, and in my book, which I'm sure, you know, will be in the show notes, it's called The Color of Everything, and it's my life. I write a lot about my adolescence there because I wanted to give people a framework for how life evolved. And so for a very long time, I would have told you that my adolescence was the darkest period. And there was a lot of darkness there. I would actually say, more recently, there was a very dark moment after Dalagiri. Very, very dark. Very confusing. Letting go, as you pointed out earlier, identity, who I was to the world, who I was to myself. Certainly very unsure about that. And then there was a moment after a very hard, hard breakup. It was that one that I'm not saying it was a healthy relationship. In fact, it wasn't. But that breakup, I was living in Thailand with her at the time. We had moved over there, and then we split up and that's talked about in the book a lot. And there was a very hard reason for that split. And I came back to LA and I just didn't have, I just didn't have anything. And I'm not talking about the things that we have. I'm talking about, I didn't have there were things. I didn't have a place to live. I didn't have a car. I had some bags. I didn't have a lot of money. And I moved into this it was like a broom closet. I couldn't afford anything else. I moved into this tiny apartment in a beautiful neighborhood, but tiny, tiny apartment. And I remember the smell. It was dark during the day. It was too light at night. It was a bed and a kitchen in, I think, probably 200 square feet. And I'd already started writing the book at this point, but I remember just being so depressed because I didn't know what came next. I had sort of, I don't want to say lost everything, but it felt so isolating and so empty. And at the same time, when I had moved to LA in 2021, I had met somebody named Kenny Kane, who owns the gym that I go to, one of the gyms that I go to. And Kenny is, he's a profound connector. And he is a deeply, deeply passionate guy who is all about forming community. And I started doing men's work with a group of guys, really interesting group of guys. You know, we had one A-list actor in there. We had a former NFL player. We had a, former professional basketball player. And then we've got finance guys. It was a group of like eight of us, former, Green Beret, who was the CEO of, one of the big movie studios here. And it was in that darkness that I started to see this realignment around community. I had been living my life completely solo, meaning I was all about me and I was pursuing somehow myself in all of it. And that illumination became profound. And it was in that darkness, and this is the thing that people just tend to miss, man. It was in that darkness that I completely changed. It hurt so much. It hurt so much. Every day was just like, oh God, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And there was this, why does this happen? Why does this? And this is where I started to really come up with how I speak about resilience now in these four categories. The first one being agency instead of blame. Blame is just another word for stuck. And then tolerance, and that's where we have to learn to fail. We have to be able to tolerate the intolerable emotions of ambiguity, of not knowing. Because once we take agency, we're necessarily thrust into a space of ambiguity, like the fires here recently. Blame the fire department, you can blame the city, you can blame the mayor, it does nothing. Your house burned down. That's agency. I have to take care of it. And then you get thrust into the space of complete ambiguity. What do I do? And it's very uncomfortable. And there's a lot of solutions, but they're not necessarily answers. And so you have to learn how to endure those spaces. And the only way to endure those spaces is with community. And then the third component, once you're in that space of tolerance, it's a good time to shut up and start listening, two ears, one mouth. And because one of the responses or one of the reactions to ambiguity is to become very certain of things, especially when things feel uncertain, we gravitate towards it because it gives us comfort, but we oftentimes get caught in an echo chamber. And it's just reinforced beliefs and ideas. And oftentimes that's going back to blame. We're outsourcing our pain. But so certainty is the death of curiosity. And once we start to listen more to the world around us, to our community, then we move into a space of creativity. Because once we've started to take on this information, we're able to imagine new paths forward. And the fourth sort of concentric circle here is adaptation. And that's when we start to actually take action around the creativity. And this still requires tolerance. It still requires avoiding blame, because so often when we start to adapt, one of the things that we try to do is we try to remake the past. And you have to be very careful, because you can't remake the past. And once you've sort of gone through these stages, you end up at evolution. And that's what resilience is. It's the difference between survival and resilience is survival is a reaction. And certainly there's space for that. Resilience is a response. And it's a response that if pursued with integrity and understanding our values and letting those underwrite the entire process, is a response that leads us to the most generative and positive outcome after the loss that whatever has happened has created. And so all of this is to say that I've gone through tremendous learning over the past 4 or 5 years. And it all started with the avalanche, where it thrust me into a confrontation with who I was in my totality, my past. I came up with the stories. I understood mental health. I used all the words, but I was stuck in the stories. And by virtue of that, I was not actually resilient. I was just trying to remake the past or repeating patterns. And so I was doing things, and some of them were very positive, but I wasn't remaking things. And it wasn't until, you know, my dad was diagnosed with cancer, I lost this relationship, and I was totally isolated, that I was pushed into the space of community that Kenny brought me into, and I continue to work in through my immense work, that I started to understand what resilience is. And so it was because of that darkness that I now live the way I do, and I have what I have, and it's enough, and it's fucking beautiful. It's astonishing when I take a moment every day to look around me and see that everything around me is worthy of gratitude, every single thing. And that has changed everything.
Do you think it takes a certain degree of darkness for people to make them see the light?
It's duality. Of course it does. Light by itself is just light. You know, we don't understand it. Everything is referential. Everything is relational. And so life to me is not about escaping pain. It's not about bypassing it. It's not about sort of just retelling a story that evades it, because that's also not honest, but it's about embracing it and turning into it without indulging it, so that we can expand our capacity to help other people move through it. And that is its own act of service. So taking on our pain, taking on our loss, learning resilience grows us to a place where we can then become the shelter and safe harbor for others, and build community around mutual support, values, integrity, that allows us to move forward in the world in service of others.
It's funny. See, when you're a very in-depth person, it's quite fascinating talking to you, because there seems to be layers upon layers. If you were to talk to your 20-year-old self right now, mm-hmm. What would you tell him?
Do exactly what you're going to do. I wouldn't tell him. I would say, trust yourself. Trust this process. That's it. Because had I not done it, had I not gone through it, had I not burnt it down, built it up, Had I not lived every single moment of my life exactly as I have, I wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be doing this podcast. We wouldn't have had this lovely, amazing conversation that's made me think and made me explore and hopefully has brought other people some exploration of their own, you know? So I would just tell him to do exactly what he's going to do, you know? And I know some people would be like, well, avoid pain, don't hurt people, all that, you know, or like, oh man, it's part of it. It's just part of it. There are no, maybe what I would say is, look, there are no right or wrong decisions. There are only decisions and consequence. And some of them are going to suck. And some of them are going to be great. But take that story out and just do what you're going to do. Because you're going to end up in a place that you absolutely fucking love.
I think that was a pretty perfect answer if I've heard one. And on the subject of places that you love, do you have, I mean, you've traveled to so many places around the world doing photography or adventures or mountaineering or climbing or just travel in general. Do you have one specific place that you love above all else? I hope it's Scotland, but if it's not, I won't be offended.
Dumbarton. No, I do. And this is one question so many people like, what's your favorite expedition? What's your favorite, you know, tell me one thing. And I never really liked that question, but this is one I can answer. My favorite place in the whole world is called Mustang. And it's on the board, it's spelled Mustang, but it's on the border of Nepal and Tibet. And it's a high desert. And it's in the rain shadow of the Himalaya. It spills. It's sort of the bridge between the Kalagandaki Gorge, which runs right through it, is the bridge between the Tibetan Plateau and the Indian subcontinent. It's an old piece of the Silk Road. And I've probably spent, you know, close to collectively a year there throughout my life. I believe in spirituality now. I don't believe necessarily that people can interpret it that how they want. It's not about one name for God. It's about God as a totality, as a oneness. But I would call that my spiritual home. And it speaks to me in a way that no place ever has. Partly because, you know, it's so deeply Buddhist that it examples the state of impermanence that we all live in that is so uncomfortable. But I love it there. I love the smells. I love the colors. I love the light. I love the people. I love the dust. I love the dirt. I love the yak dung and the monasteries and the goats and the mountains and the snow and the thousands of caves that dot the walls and the, it's just, yeah, that's it.
Is it peace to you?
Yeah, it's pure peace because there's so much mystery there. And I think that's like my friend Lauren Tao, superstar therapist. She always says life is mystery school. And yeah, it gives me a sense of wonder and curiosity.
And that's what life's about. I think that is what, you know, when you remove that from life, people lose their purpose. If you remove their wonder and remove their need to explore, you take away something really fundamental and really, you know, ingrained in the human brain. And I think it really messes with people. And I think that you're very lucky that you found a job, as am I, that you can do that travel and you can maintain that sense of wonder in the world. I know that you're quite tight for time, so I'm going to ask you one more question, because we've touched on everything. I could probably talk to you for hours, but we've kind of touched on everything. Who is Corey Richards?
This is a really actually a great way to wrap it up. I talk a lot about storytelling and what that really is, and this might, again, people might roll their eyes. I don't care. Anytime we say I am and then we follow it with something, or I can't, or I won't, or I shouldn't, or I can, or I will, we're telling a story. And The only thing, you know, if I was going to apply a label to myself, I would say artist. I would say communicator, you know. But really, at the end of the day, the only way to answer that with any honesty is simply, I am. That's it. I am. And the many manifestations and different directions that takes are all expressions of me. So when we say I am, it creates a totality around us that allows us both to be free and secure in who we are, however that is defined at any given point in our lives. I am. And that's who Corey Richards is.
I think that's a pretty good answer.
Yeah.
I think it's a good one. I think it's a good one. I think, yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good one. I've asked that in quite a few podcasts, and yeah. you normally get quite similar-ish answers, and I can honestly say that that's totally different to what I've heard before.
Good. I like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, listen, Corey, I know that you've got to run. The Color of Everything, your new book, will be in the link below, so everyone Great. Can get it there. And I just want to say, mate, a heartfelt thank you. You know, it's not often that you get people that are in the public eye like you are, that are so responsive. I honestly thought when I shot you an email, I was like, yes, he's never going to reply. but you did. So honestly, mate, I really, really appreciate it. I appreciate you and appreciate the time.
Yeah, thank you so much. Great questions. This has been one of the best I've done. Truly, I mean that from the bottom of my heart. And I just appreciate you following your instincts and making me think and asking interesting stuff. It's been a total pleasure.